Okay, hello everyone. We're back with another podcast about languages. This is Ryan, the linguist blogger, and got my friend Cameron with me here again.
Hello.
All right, how you doing, Cameron?
I'm doing well, doing well.
I've got a question for you. Why is it, do you think people lie about whether or not they know a language?
That's a really good question. I don't know how much you've come across it.
Well, I'll tell you how I've been coming across it a lot lately. What's been going on is I'll get on to ShareTalk.com. No, Rosetta Stone did not pay me to make a plug for this. It's a language exchange website, and they've got a platform for even doing voice chat in addition to text chatting. Anyway, I get on there to practice my German, and Germans, you guys are way... I don't know if you're just not interested in learning languages or if you guys are just really, really timid, but I just don't find very many Germans on there. And I'll go on during the times of day when, you know, I think that Germans have time, like, you know, around 8 o'clock German time, 9 o'clock, 7 o'clock, I'll vary it up. Luckily, I have a flexible schedule so I can kind of often squeeze it in there. Anyway, since I can't find Germans a lot, what I do is I look for other people who are looking to practice their German. And so on the website, you can see, okay, list for native languages, list for languages you're wanting to practice. And that's what it says, practicing languages. And what happens is I get on there and I'll send out an invite to someone who says that they're interested in learning English and German, Spanish and German, just as long as German's one of the options. And I'll say, hey, so yeah, I'll send out an invite and I'm like, hallo, wie geht's? And then just, you know, silence. Hallo, hallo, kannst du mich hören? And okay, anybody wants to, you know, any German speaker can verify. That's nothing. That's nothing. My German's really not that good. But hallo, hallo, kannst du mich hören? Ich kann dich nicht hören. And I'll almost invariably get, do you speak English? And I find out, you know, yeah, yes, I'm American, I do speak English. Kannst du Deutsch? Ich möchte Deutsch sprechen. Kannst du ein bisschen Deutsch? You know, just real basic stuff. Hey, I want to learn German. Can you practice German? You speak German? And then I find out that, oh, it's, I just started learning German last week. You know, why do people do that, do you think?
I don't know. I think... The one I've been seeing lately is Facebook. The past 6 months or so, I don't know how long ago exactly it was, but this option came up under your profile information where you could say which languages you speak. And there are people that I have known and that I see this appear on their Facebook all of a sudden saying speaks Spanish and English. And I know they don't speak Spanish. They did, you know, one or two classes in high school, and that's about it. I don't know, maybe in that sort of situation people wouldn't lie about it unless they're given the opportunity, because they didn't tell me that they spoke Spanish. I don't know, I think it would depend also on just sort of the circle that you're in. When would it benefit you to lie about your abilities in a language or to exaggerate?
Yeah, see, I can see exaggeration, especially in a job situation. You know, if you're going to go work for a company and they say, you know, German is a plus or Japanese is a plus, and you can get by, I can see you exaggerating by saying, fluent is such a wishy-washy term, fluent in, you know, whatever, Japanese. Of course, the thing is, though, if I put something down on a resume, you gotta think, it's fair game for them to bring somebody in. Or worse, the interviewer themselves is going to come in and you know, they're going to start speaking to you in whatever language is. So, yeah, I think that'd be really embarrassing. If they put Spanish on their resume and they're like, oh, so you speak Spanish, yeah. Fill it up in this day. I'm sorry.
Yeah, I think the most visible example I've ever seen of that, or should I say the most embarrassing, was Tom Cruise was on... one of the British interview shows, I can't remember which one, and the following guest was going to be Stephen Fry, who, if you know who Stephen Fry is, very intelligent historian and comedian in England, and is very interested in languages. So the interviewer says, well, because they've been filming the movie Valkyrie in, I believe, in Berlin, or was it Munich? I
think it was Southern Germany.
Yeah. And the interviewer asked Tom Cruise if he speaks German. He said, yeah, I understand. I understand it pretty well. I picked up a lot of it when I was there. And you know, I don't really speak all that well, but I can understand it. And he said, oh, really? And then the interviewer said, hey, Stephen Fry, don't you speak German? And he said, yeah, it's a beautiful language. Sort of spits this out in German and starts speaking to Tom Cruise. And you see him kind of, you know, deer in the headlights. And you realize that he doesn't really speak German and didn't expect to be put into that situation. And he kind of goes, well, I can't really understand the way you speak. I must have learned a dialect. That's kind of the worst I've ever seen.
Yeah, and what stinks for Tom Cruise is, you know, he did that on national television.
Yeah.
Yep. Okay, so yeah, why is it people lie? Anyway, listeners, you got any ideas? Put it in the comment section. We'd love to hear your experiences about people that you've come across that lie. Maybe you can tell us about maybe when you lied about a language you didn't really speak, or why does you think that other people lie or grossly exaggerate their language abilities? But anyway, so put that in the comment section. Next thing I think would be kind of fun to talk about is probably the best advice I ever got when it comes to learning a language is there you're going to make 10,000 mistakes before you start speaking well. 10,000. So you might as well just start making them now. So, you know, and that was our teacher's way of telling us, you know, get out there whenever you can practice your language, get out there and do it. So anyway, why do you think that is, Cameron? Or do you think that is? You know, do you think that making mistakes is part of the language learning process? Can you avoid it?
You can't avoid learning a foreign language without making mistakes. I think you can learn as much vocabulary as you want. Just go through vocab list after vocab list. But when it comes to actually speaking in an idiomatic way, speaking the way that the people actually speak, that's something that only really comes through comparison. And through comparison, you have to make mistakes because you just say, a lot of times you just are making up a phrase or saying a phrase as best as you would imagine it would be said in the foreign language. And then the native speaker or your teacher says, no, I understand what you're saying, but we say it this way. And so I think that it's, you can't really avoid that. You can't really avoid making mistakes until you get to that situation. When I was learning my first foreign language, which was Spanish, and I was in the missionary training center, they told us that statistic that they told you know, 10,000 mistakes in order to become fluent in a language. And my attitude was, well, mistake number one, here we go. And I know that statistic can intimidate a lot of people, but I had the attitude that I was going to dominate Spanish, so it was never really that big of a thing for me. But I've run into people who've had a real tough time with getting out and speaking to people because they're afraid of making those mistakes. And I never really have. The only time I kind of get butterflies in my stomach is when I'm learning a language and I hear somebody speaking that language on the street, and it's my opportunity to speak with them, and I know I'm not super comfortable with my language abilities yet. Then I get the butterflies in my stomach, but I still generally do it.
So you're saying in a classroom setting, you have no problem just getting out there and butchering it just to start doing it.
Yeah. I blurt things out. I just go for it. I go for it. Because I think it appeals to my adventurous side in the sense that I will shoot for something that I may or may not get, and it's pretty awesome when you are just making a guess as to how something would sound or how it should be, and you get it right.
Yeah, I agree. Yep, that's totally cool. That's totally cool. Yeah, so guys, get over yourselves. those of you who are having a hard time learning whatever your language is, Spanish, Portuguese, Korean, Japanese, Italian, French, Chinese, you know, any language, get over yourselves. Get over yourselves. It's real good to find a language learning partner who can be patient with you. In fact, one thing I've been doing with a couple of with a couple of Germans is we'll switch. Like, we'll talk over Skype, and we'll switch languages every 10 or 15 minutes or so. And what's nice about that is, because language exchanges can be tricky, because quite often what happens is you get, you either get somebody who's very timid or very aggressive. So you get somebody who's very timid, and once they realize that you can speak their language, well, in my case, what happens, I'll talk to a Brazilian. Once the Brazilian can hear that I speak fluent Portuguese, they generally, not always, they generally don't want to speak to me in English anymore. And I don't know, I kind of feel bad about that, because I'm like, well, this is supposed to be an exchange, right? You know, we're supposed to, I'm supposed to be helping you out. I don't have very many opportunities to speak Portuguese, really, and I imagine you don't have very many opportunities to speak English. So, you know, come on. Like, oh, no, it's okay. It's all right. Let's speak Portuguese. Conversely, what happens with, I've heard and had this experience a bit with Chinese, is the Chinese are super aggressive. Not in a mean way or a rude way, but they just want to speak English. 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 And that's not cool either, because you're not really learning. So that's why I like this new little thing I'm doing. In fact, I did... We switched. We switched going back and forth every 15 minutes, and it's actually kind of fun, and that way we both get it in there. I have to say, I get my I get much less eloquent when we switch into German, but oh well. And I would have to say that's another caveat I have to say with the whole 10,000 mistake thing, because if you just there's some people I've seen who get into the habit of butchering the language, and they get comfortable with that. Have you ever come across that?
Yeah, a lot, in fact, I would say. In fact, I remember first doing Spanish and being hanging around with a, what do you call, mission companion, my first missionary that I was assigned with, who was supposed to sort of help me, ease me into the work, and be sort of the guide for the language. I remember being about 3 weeks in, getting really frustrated because subjunctive is kind of hard for Americans or English speakers to understand, sure. And a lot of times, and in the missionary training center, our teachers had learned Spanish as missionaries, at least the ones who weren't native speakers, and they often were intimidated and had sidestepped the use of subjunctive, because you don't need it to get by. People will understand you, people know what you're getting at, but you'll never sound like you have a command of the language if you never use subjunctive correctly. So I remember telling my companion, like, hey, we need to study subjunctive, because I noticed he never used it. And we sort of sat down and went through our books, and I read the first paragraph about it, and I said, does that make sense? And he got really upset and said, it's just not important. And it was just because it was something that I think intimidated him about it. And so I met a lot of people that just never bothered with subjunctive. And for me, the great divide between a solid Spanish speaker and one who's content enough to get by or just to communicate is the use of the subjunctive. If you're using it properly and correctly, then I know you've really put a lot of care and time into this language. So yeah.
I would say that's one of the keys to success with language learning is, on the one hand, to be laid back enough and relaxed enough, just not to take yourself so seriously. That's something that was killing my German in the beginning. I was taking myself way too seriously. Relax, don't take yourself too seriously, make the mistakes. But on the other hand, try to be better than you were the previous day. So, you know, whatever it is you do to learn vocab, whether it's reading or going through vocab lists or writing things out, whatever it is, flashcards, yeah, make sure you do that. You know, jot little stuff down after you just butchered the language with a patient native speaker for 5 minutes. You know, those can be your best classes. So go and do your homework afterwards, once your weaknesses have been exposed.
Actually, I had a funny little experience about a week and a half ago, sitting in Serbian class, and we were asking different questions, and I thought it would be funny to say to my teacher, I want to be a sandwich. Hmm. Just because I thought it would be kind of weird, and I just wanted to see, you know, make people giggle. But I said it wrong. So instead of saying, volim da jedem sandwich, I want to be a sandwich, I said, Dali Volite, the Jedem sandwich, which was, do you want me to be a sandwich? And the teacher thought it was the funniest thing in the world. And it was a, you know, it was a ridiculous mistake, but now it's the running joke in class.
Oh, no.
So if I say a mistake or I'm starting to, like, sort of take my time with something or not come out clearly what I'm trying to say, she'll say, do I want you to be a sandwich? Like, it's becoming the joke now. So mistakes can be funny, too, if you laugh at it and have a good time. It's not that big of a deal.
Yeah, don't take yourself too seriously. But do your homework afterwards. try to figure that out. In fact, Stuart J. Raj, and for those of you who don't know who Stuart J. Raj is, Google him, look him up on YouTube. You're going to find some really cool videos. One of the things that, he's a very good linguist, I think, a very good polyglot anyway. And one of the things that he says is, if you think you know Thai, because Thai is one of his strongest languages, if you think you know Thai, shut up. And because the thing is, I think his main message there is, maybe you can conjugate the verbs, maybe you can get the syntax right, maybe your mastery of the tones is plenty good enough for the Thais to understand you, but then there's that whole other cultural element. And he goes on to explain that a lot of times Thai think that farang. I think it's funny how so many languages seem to have a somewhat derogatory term for a big white foreigner. In Spanish, you've got gringo. Farang is apparently, I know I'm butchering the tones, but that's apparently the Thai term for big white foreigner. So anyway, they find that Westerners, they think Westerners just talk about the stupidest things. It's a cultural, and it's cultural. So one thing is being able to express your, you know, basic thoughts and feelings and ideas, and it's another to figure out, to really interact in the culture. So, so don't take yourself too seriously and don't be afraid. Like you said, there's that exchange, that there's that comparison. I really think the native speaker needs to always be who we measure ourselves to or compare ourselves to, especially an educated, somewhat educated native speaker. Not that you're going to kill yourself if you don't ever, you know, sound exactly like him, but, you know, that's who you're comparing yourself to. One would hope. Anyway. All right. So mistakes and, all right, there's this guy I came across a little while ago. He is some type of Muay Thai fighter, but he was in the armed forces, and so he has a background in languages as well. Probably where he came into contact with both the languages and the combat, hand-to-hand combat. Anyway, the guy's supposed to, I looked him up, and gosh, for the life of me, for the moment, I can't think of his name. Many of you have probably come across him. Anyway, so he's supposed to be very, very good, a very, very good fighter, or was at some point. And I think he kind of brings that to the debates, or to when he weighs in on things on YouTube. The guy is incredibly aggressive. Ad hominem attacks, very, very insulting. And I think that he's just bringing his attitude from the ring into the realm of languages, you know? So, anyway, chill out, man. We're language enthusiasts. Chill out. One of his big things is, if you're not a linguist unless you have a master's in linguists. And I get your point. Was Colonel Sanders a member of the military when he was selling Kentucky Fried Chicken?
I don't think so.
I don't think he was. It might just kind of be a gimmick. Okay, so I realize that. I realize that as a linguist blogger, it's kind of a moniker. It's kind of a name. I do not, folks, have a degree in linguistics. I recognize that. But it's a fun name for a blog. And I'm not selling anything. So anyway, but one of the things that if you can get past his grating personality, at least that's the way he comes across on YouTube, you can tell the guy's actually got some, he's done some pretty good, he has access to good studies and good good linguistic information. And someone he recommended was Dr. James J. Asher, as being, you know, the guy who's done some really great studies when it comes to language, teaching languages. And I would so I Googled him and I looked up some stuff and I read a couple of his papers. Pretty cool. But one of the things he says is, okay, so a lot of the language learning methods out there, if you go to Teach Yourself, you go to Colloquial, or even Pimsleur or Michelle Thomas, it's very translation oriented. You know, here's the phrase in the native language, or here's the phrase in your target language, here's the phrase in your native language. Okay, they're more or less equivalents. We're going to teach you the grammar principle behind it, and then, you know, you go through the lesson. At the end of the lesson, they either play a recording and say, okay, what did this person say? You're supposed to try to figure it out. You should be able to figure it out. So there's some translation work going on there. Or they say, okay, now you want to buy some coffee. You're at the cafe. Order a large coffee. I don't know. Something like that. And that also involves translation. Well, what this guy says, Dr. Asher says, that involves, you know, the left side of your brain. And the left side of your brain is kind of picky about what it wants to remember and what it wants to forget. And so if it doesn't see something as very, very important, it's going to forget it. What you want to do is you want to get learning, involve your right, the right side of the brain, because the right side of the brain, the creative side of your brain apparently doesn't have as good of a filter. So that explains a lot of artists and musicians and such that I've come across. They're really fun, but yeah, don't expect them to arrive on time necessarily. So I was looking at what... I thought, okay, Dr. Asher, you make some good points here. That's interesting. You want to involve... He's big on involving the body, involving, you know, a physical action and an image to what it is you're learning. That goes along with a lot of didactic tools and techniques I've come across, because, you know, there's some people who are very... You always talk about how you're very visual.
I'm very visual. But it's interesting that you talk about people doing actions and things and moving their bodies. I've had people in language classes who they cannot remember something unless they're moving at the time. Or one guy said, hey, you know, he would have a ball. He said, play with a ball while you're memorizing words. It works. And it just, something with a physical movement helps memorization for those people. For me, no, not at all.
Yeah, those people are what you call kinesthetic learners, mm-hmm. right? They associate movement. And yeah, they're geniuses when you can, well, not necessarily geniuses, but they come alive when you do that. I have a brother who's that way. And you're visual, and I tend to be quite auditory, sometimes visual. Anyway, but you have people who are auditory learners, you know, tell me, let me hear it, and I can do it. Anyway, and so Dr. Asher's big on that. Okay, you got visuals, you got physical movement. So I thought, all right. In a very indirect way, he's kind of bad-mouthing the competition. He's not really bad-mouthing them. He's an academic, but he's saying that he has a better way, and, you know, he's done studies. Okay, cool. So I get on his website, and I look at the stuff you can buy. I'm curious. And I'm sure this is not all that Dr. Asher has to buy, but to sell. But I saw a bunch of his activities have to do with, like, matching stickers. You know, you've got a diagram of a bedroom, and then you've got all these figures on the right with the foreign word on the figure. So blanket, right? And then you've got, for Spanish, it would be frazada.
Mm-hmm.
Portuguese would be coberto, right? And then... the idea is you put the blanket on the bed, and you got the symbol for bed and the word for bed and all of that. And I remember thinking, you know, this could very possibly work quite well, and that's all well and good. And it's very definitely in line with the stuff he's been talking about, and that's cool. But I remember thinking, this is so simple. You know, it's not very doesn't seem very revolutionary in and of itself. I don't know. What are your thoughts?
Well, the thing is that how do you get into explain abstract concepts through stickers? You know,
mm-hmm.
How do you describe the movement of particles in nuclear physics with stickers. You know, when it comes to that sort of stuff, I like you said, it's very simple. I think it would work on a very elementary level, on a very introductory level. But when you get into abstract concepts, moods, things like that, then it becomes more difficult.
I imagine, I don't know, but I imagine they've got, like, faces for that, you know. Happy, they got a smiley face, sad.
Mm-hmm.
They got a, you know, sticker of a person who looks sad.
Yeah, I'm trying to think of just a better example, though, in terms of something like really abstract, like, oh, I don't know.
Longing?
Yeah, longing.
You make a face that conveys longing effectively.
Yeah. Or just, you know, yeah, how do you do that? Or
rejection.
Yeah. You're supposed to draw up stickers for every single concept. I mean, I can see it as being very introductory. Mm. That kind of stuff, I never like it. I don't like silly dialogues. I like things to be as real world as possible. Mm. So I like to create dialogues that I'm going to use talking about things that I want to talk about. And that really helps me. It helps me put it into context and to helps me remember it more than games and activities. And
in all fairness, I do think these were made by children. Gosh, I should do my research a little bit better before I start talking and then opening that up to the world. Okay, but that brings me to the point I wanted to make as I was looking at all this stuff. I thought, you know, it is so hard to teach something effectively when the learner perceives it as abstract. If they perceive it as concrete, so much easier. And if something's applicable, they're thinking this is being concrete. So I think what happens to a lot of language learners is when they're studying, especially the first foreign language, it sounds like gibberish. They can't really imagine that people talk this way without thinking. They have no point of reference. And that's why, I remember when I was learning Spanish, there's this guy who thought that the word for I worked, trabajaba, sounded really funny. And you know, he just laughed when he heard it. He's like, trabajaba, 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 trabajaba. And I remember thinking, dude, people talk like that. Anyway, when I got down to South America, I remember some guys, okay, so yeah, when we're in the class, you know, people laugh. Jabba-haba, jabba-haba, jabba-haba. You get down there, nobody thinks you're funny. Nobody, all the, but the thing is, before it was an abstract, funny sound, right? Mm-hmm. And you get in with the people, and you realize, oh, you're the idiot. You know, all of a sudden, it becomes concrete. It becomes applicable. And that's why I think that some of these games can be good for a lot of people, because somehow it helps them see the language as being something concrete. And I think that's why what works for you is looking over dialogues, starting with dialogues and especially vocabulary that is applicable and interesting to you right away. It's because it's concrete. It becomes real.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's what I call, you know, making the language your own.
Mm-hmm.
You put it in context and it becomes something that you feel and understand, as opposed to just a word list or things like that. So yeah,
I was talking to this guy who was living in Spain. He was a Navy brat, and the biggest motivator was trying to buy beer. You know, he said, "There's beer. They'll sell it to you. You just gotta learn."
That's funny.
But I think that's really what kills a lot, not just language class, I think math class as well. Lots of different subjects. It's abstract. And only the kids who have the maturity or the interest or the inclination to deal with an abstract concept, or to just happen to think it's cool,
mm-hmm,
in and of itself as an idea, are they going to be the ones that learn. It doesn't mean the other kids aren't capable. It's too darn abstract for a lot of them. What's the use for this? I don't get it. I mean, even if you can explain it to me intellectually. Yeah, like I said, they haven't made it their own. Anyway, I like that. Okay. Okay, Cameron, you speak Portuguese.
Mm-hmm.
When you speak Portuguese, what type of Portuguese are you trying to speak? Because, you know, they got Angolans, you got Portuguese, you have Brazilians. Within those different countries, there are different accents. What are you going for when you speak Portuguese?
I speak with a fairly neutral Brazilian accent. I don't really sound like I'm from São Paulo. There's a couple sounds that I don't do. I definitely don't sound from like somebody from the Northeast or from Rio. So maybe South-ish.
Okay.
South Brazil-ish. So I usually get complimented on my accent. So I'm comfortable with where it is.
Right, right. But how did you come across that? Why did you decide on a South-ish Portuguese accent?
Well, I actually started off with an accent from Rio because it was what was in the language learning series that I had. It was the accent they were using. Mm-hmm. But I didn't like it as much. I like the sound of the more mainstream accent. But why did I pick Brazilian over, say, Portuguese from Portugal? Mm-hmm. A lot of it had to do with the fact that I really liked South America. And I wanted to speak with a dialect from South America, as well as my Spanish. So that was a big thing. And I like the funny, what came across as funny sound changes. So T followed by an I or an E, because it's a ch. So main chi instead of mint. Dialogo instead of dialogo, you know, things like that. I really like the sounds of it as well. So it was a cultural travel and just because it sounded cool. It was all an interest that had to do with that.
Okay. Do you find European Portuguese just to be almost a different language?
I thought it was too close to... No, I don't think so. I can understand it. I don't have...
A really hard time talking to European Portuguese speakers?
Only when we went to that Azorean festival.
No, that's different. That's the Azores.
Yeah.
Everybody else, even native Portuguese speakers have a hard time understanding those guys.
No, Portuguese from Portugal I don't find to be that difficult. It sounds like a slurred Spanish from Spain to me in a lot of ways. And that was one of the reasons as well why I think I went Brazilian Portuguese was that it was more different in a relationship to Spanish than the other dialects. So,
well, see that those have been a lot of those. I've had a lot of the same experiences, and I one of the questions I've gotten from people is, "Oh, I'm learning English, but I'm learning British English. I just don't know if I'm going to be able to understand Americans." Or, "Oh, it's because you speak with an American accent." And I'm like, you know, I rarely have problems understanding Brits or Kiwis or Aussies. I really don't. And people I know that get to an advanced level of English, American English, generally at an advanced level, they don't have very many problems understanding Brits or Aussies or Kiwis or even South Africans. And so I get that with people that, you know, that they're so scared that if they learn one variety of a language, that that's just going to cut them off from the rest of the speakers. Unless you're getting into a language where they're really cheating, like Chinese, I think it's cheating. Cantonese is not, okay, the Hong Kongers can't understand people from Beijing without going to school, I'm sorry, it's a different language. I know you characters are all the same. That's great, but it's a different language. You guys can't understand each other. Okay, when you have those types of dialects, yeah, you have to pick a dialect because they're really languages. But in every other case, I think, like, yes, English or Spanish or Portuguese, even German, frankly, with maybe the exception of Swiss German. You almost can't find any language learning courses to teach you Swiss German. I think if you learn Hochdeutsch standard German, but if you end up going down to Bavaria and talking with people, if you get to an advanced level of the language, you're gonna have no problem if you go to Berlin or Hanover or Dusseldorf. Cologne, And that's really how I feel. That's been my experience with every language. So don't worry about it, folks. If you're learning English or French or whatever, don't worry about learning the other dialects too much, the other varieties too much. I remember, like, when I was learning Portuguese, I wanted to make sure that I studied at least what the European Portuguese were saying. So I'd read some of their stuff, or I'd go, I would pay attention to the examples in the book. You know, they say tu. Okay, great. Tu és. They don't say você é. Tu és. Okay, you know, that's not hard. They don't say você está falando. Tu estás a falar. But that's just not crazy different, you know? Mm-hmm. That's not, oh my gosh, that's killer. I remember talking to a German, and I go, yeah, try some dialect on me. And they did, and I went, okay, that's different, but that's not bad. That's not bad. I understand what you're saying. So anyway, don't worry about dialects too much, folks. If you learn one, you're going to be okay with the others.
Well, I'm in an interesting situation because I'm in a program now where it's called Serbian and Croatian. Mm-hmm. Or Serbo-Croatian, depending upon how you want to look at that. And it's really quite interesting because we are required to learn two different dialects of the same language, and we're tested on them. Serbian and Croatian. But different teachers have different ideas as to if those are considered different languages or different dialects. Mm-hmm. You know, one teacher is like, no, you guys will be learning four different languages. You will be learning Serbian and Croatian and Bosnian and Montenegrin. And by my standards, the variation is not between, like, Croatian and Serbian. It's closer. No, it's about the same as, like, Mexican and Argentine Spanish. They're
noticeable, but not a big deal.
Yeah, they're vocab differences, spelling differences, pronunciation differences, but they understand each other just fine. Mm-hmm. The big hurdle to overcome is kind of getting over vocab, because the Serbs have allowed lots of loanwords to come in from German and from English and from French and from Russian, and the Croats have systematically gone through their vocabulary and removed those words and replaced them with words of Slavic origin. That's kind of an interesting thing. But if we're talking about accents, it's been difficult to try to decide which accent I want to speak with. Although I don't think the accents are too much different. I think the Serbs sound a bit more Slavic, a bit more Russian. I think it has to do with the influence of Eastern Europe on them more than Croatia, which has generally been aligned more with the Catholic Church in the West. The Croats seem to speak a bit more clearly. Their vowels sound more like Italian, if you will. But I think I've been going with Serbian mainly because most of my teachers are Serbs. Mm-hmm. And also because I think that's kind of where the political powerhouse is right now. And then where things are, you know, the more interest in what's going on in the future, and, you know, getting Serbia to join the EU is going to be a bigger hurdle than Croatia, which has been accepted to join in 2013. So for me, I've decided to do Serbian mainly because that's what's most readily available for me right now, and also because I think it's more interesting politically. But yeah.
That leads me to another point, is that whenever you're going to learn a language, pick a dialect. Don't mix.
Well, we have to mix. when it comes to speaking...
But are you going to mix at the same time?
Well, the thing is that we're expected to be able... We're going to be tested on both at the same time. So,
like, I'm talking about within a single sentence.
You're not going to change it within a single sentence. Or so,
like, either when you're talking with a Serb, you're going to speak with... You're going to speak Serbian, or with that accent, that dialect. When you talk with a Croat, you're going to... Switch.
If I want to do really, really well in the program, I have to be able to do that. Yeah.
Yeah, yeah. But what I'm saying is, for the average language learner who's not going to go through that, they're probably just going to hang out in one area.
Yeah, they just go with your one dialect. Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
But it's important to pick the dialect. Pick a dialect, whatever it is you like. So when it comes to Portuguese, pick between the European variety and the South American variety. You're going for English, you know, I've talked to Vietnamese, and, well, not very many Vietnamese, but Chinese people who are like, yeah, you know, I mean, it's either British English or American English. I'm thinking, it's so much easier for you guys to go to Australia. Learn on the Australian variety, which is different. It's different. It's not exactly the same as British or American. Yeah, learn that. So whatever the dialect is, stick to it. Stick to it, and you should be fine with everybody else, as long as you know the important differences. And that's a lot of times that has to do with vocabulary. Mm-hmm. Okay, I've got an Argentine friend, right, and good Argentine buddy, and he was living with a Colombian family when he came to the States. The Colombian, the lady of the house, saying, "Hey, I'm going out, but I want you to turn off la estufa after 20 minutes. Now, to me and to her, estufa is stove. But to him, when people are talking about, you know, your gas range / oven unit, mm-hmm. apparently in Córdoba, Argentina, that's cocina. So turn off the cocina. So she said, turn off the estufa. Estufa to him meant like your
the water heater for the shower?
Yeah, like your water heater. Sure. Mm-hmm. And so, no, actually it was like your house heater.
When it gets
cold, you turn the thermostat up so that the heat comes on.
Uh-huh.
And so 20 minutes later, he went to the thermostat and turned it off, turned the heat off. A little while later, the black smoke started coming out of the kitchen. And she got all mad at him, you know, why'd you turn it off? He's like, look, I went to the estufa and I turned it off after 20 minutes. You should have told me you had rice going. So I think vocabulary differences are a little bit, if you're going to learn the differences between the dialects, I think generally, vocabulary differences are the ones you want to go to. I mean, if you learn the American variety and go over to Great Britain and you say you're going to... you say if you're going to walk on the pavement, you know, it means something a little bit different. Or I'm going to drive on the pavement. Huh? No, you can't drive on the pavement. Mm-hmm. Not in Great Britain. So learning vocabulary differences, I think, is important.
Yeah, definitely.
Okay. So we've noticed that... So I'm learning German on my own right now. And you're getting paid to learn Serbo-Croatian. Former Yugoslavian. However you want to call it.
Depends on who you're talking
to. Depends on who you're talking. Our language.
Our language, as they call it, to not offend each other. Yep. Yeah.
Okay, so all Indo-European, right? Tell people what case endings are, just really briefly, for those who don't know what case endings are.
A case basically is... I would say morphology, but I don't want to get too deep. So it's not used in linguistic terms. It's that you change a part of the word in order to show what the word's function is in the sentence. So if you, let's say you have a word house, if you want to say in the house, the word house ends differently.
Okay.
If you want to say on top of the house, it ends differently. If you want to say going to the house or coming from the house or speaking about the house, or going with the house, all these different concepts have a different ending for the word, basically. So as you read a sentence that has case endings in it, or the language that has case endings in it, and you see that ending, you know exactly what the function of that object is in the sentence, what's going on with that object. And that's essentially what it is.
Okay. All right, thanks, Cam. All right, yeah. So German has them too, but... not nearly as much as most Slavic languages.
Yep.
And so, like, I think a good example for German would be like Bekannter, like an acquaintance, mm-hmm. right? So, you could say er ist ein Bekannter von mir. He's an acquaintance of mine. Or you could say ich habe einen Bekannten. So Bekannter switches to Bekannten, like you were saying. You change the ending. Mm-hmm. The word suddenly ends in an N because it's the accusative case. Anyway, there won't be a quiz at the end of this, folks. Don't worry. But the thing is, what I think is remarkable is German doesn't really have hardly any. Well, when it comes to the nouns, you know, like you were saying, Haus changes. Haus doesn't really change in German much, except with like one case.
Yeah.
Every other time, you just leave the word alone. And the whole reason we're talking about this, the few Russians or native Russian speakers that will listen to this must be kind of rolling their eyes. Why is this significant to two native English speakers?
Because we don't really have cases all that much in English. We kind of have an accusative case with personal pronouns. So he speaks to me.
Ah.
Why do you say to me and not to I? Well,
sounds funny.
It's an accusative.
Right.
You need that with everything in the Slavic languages. So it's very important because if you don't use the cases properly, it can become very confusing as to what you're trying to say. I would hope that your goal in language learning would be to speak like a native at some point. Yeah. In order to do that, you need to do these, understand these cases. They're not as difficult as you would think they would be. You've expressed that with German. The cases aren't that bad. They're considerably more extensive in the Slavic languages, though, with 7 cases and 3 genders, it becomes quite... it's kind of like a Rubik's Cube, I say.
Uh-huh.
You know, you move one square and a bunch of other squares move to fit with it. Uh-huh. But it's not as bad as you think it is. It just takes time, but once you have it, then it becomes this beautiful form of expression, and you can let the person know exactly what you're talking about, and that person will say something back to you, and you'll understand exactly what's going on in a way that I believe is more explicit in its ability to express things than in English.
Yeah, that makes sense. But, okay, all European languages, we're talking about all European languages, right?
Mm-hmm.
Right now. I just think it's interesting that, you know, you start off there in Russia, to the way out to the east, northeast anyway. Crazy case endings, at least for us, right? Very complicated. But you start moving west and you get over to Germany. And, you know, cases are important, but it's not nearly as complicated. And then you get over into the northwest, Scandinavia, and, the Netherlands, the Dutch speakers. So you get the Scandinavian speakers and the Dutch speakers. And you've studied Scandinavians more than languages more than I have. Swedish has some case in... No?
Oh,
no,
okay. Well, it depends. If you're counting, like, plurals to be a case, which technically it is, but they usually aren't counted as such, then yes. But really, the only time you're ever going to see a case in Norwegian or Danish or Swedish is going to be in the names of certain churches and religious texts.
Right. Yeah. From old Latin terms.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. So you have words like, you know, the Church of Jesus Christ would be... Kirken Jesu Christi, you know, like you have that.
Right, yeah. Mm-hmm. The end change instead of Jesu Christus,
mm-hmm.
Yeah?
Okay. And that's a Latin, that's from the Latin, basically. It's the Latin genitive case. And that's the only time you're ever really going to see that.
Okay, so but that's my point. It's interesting, you get into German, and it seems like the cases start to fade. You go even farther west with Dutch and the Scandinavian languages, and they're almost completely gone.
Unless you count Faroese and Icelandic. And they're heavily inflected. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Okay. They're on islands.
Yeah, they're very isolated. And they have very conservative languages. Icelandic, the language hasn't changed that much over the centuries to the point where a modern Icelander can read the old Icelandic sagas in their original and except for a few changes here and there, they understand everything. So,
well, that's like us reading Shakespeare.
I think it's closer than Shakespeare is.
Wow.
Yeah.
Closer than Shakespeare?
Yeah, I'll have to show you some stuff online. It'll kind of blow your mind.
All right. But then you get over to the island. You get over to Great Britain, and no cases.
No.
No cases.
No, basically.
Basically.
Uh-huh.
But
I read a theory as well that had to do with influence of Norse invaders, basically. The language was already simplifying, and so it caused English to simplify. Whether or not that's true, I don't know, but I read a paper that suggested that as a possibility.
Yeah, because usually they blame it on the French.
Yeah.
Because, all right, check this out, guys. If you really want to see a good explanation of how English has changed over time, Dr. Arguelles, which looks like Dr. Arguelles, Dr. Arguelles has done some really great videos. They're on YouTube. They're about Old English, Middle English. I don't think he's done one on Modern English. That'd be kind of redundant, because if you're listening to his videos, you already know English. But he'll show you how Old English, or Anglo-Saxon, the language of the invaders, beat up on the native Celts, Welsh and the like, on the British Isles. You know, they had case endings. But, you know, we're talking about what? 1,200 years ago? No. Or more.
We're talking, about 1,200
years ago. Yeah, about 1,200 years ago. So 1,200 years ago, English had case endings. But yeah, once you get into what's called Middle English, which is, Old English is so different. It's not really English, guys. It's a different language entirely. You have a better chance, and a native English speaker has a better chance of reading German, modern German, than Old English. It's that different. Okay, and one of the differences is you have case endings. You get to Middle English, though, shoot, gone. And I had always been told that was the French's fault, because the Normans invaded, French became the dominant language, English, they stopped using English to write as much, which they weren't really doing tons of anyway with Old English. They blamed it on the French, but you're telling me now that it could have been partially due to the Vikings.
That's what I read. And keep in mind that, at least I've been told this in a historical linguistics class, that English as a language nearly died out because after the Normans invaded, French was the language of the aristocracy and it became the language of the cities. So guys like William Wallace probably spoke French as the native language.
Yuck.
Kind of ruins your movie there, sorry.
Sorry, guys.
But then when the Black Plague came through, it hit the city so much harder that English had a revival. Now, what happened in those centuries in terms of how much English changed, I don't know. I haven't researched that enough, but I don't know. I'd like to look into that more.
See, I've heard something a little bit different. What Cameron has just explained is the mainstream view as far as, English coming close to dying out. But I heard it and, what was I listening to? It's something on the BBC. That this one historian was saying, no, probably didn't almost die out. This because he was saying that the Normans were actually became very influenced by the English, the ones that came over here, the ones that came over to Great Britain became very influenced. They noticed that this was an advanced culture, it was a strong culture, and they started identifying themselves as being separate from mainlanders pretty early on, like within a generation, and they were saying that this was pre-nationalism, at least in Europe. And so this concept of having one national language was not as concrete back then as it is now. And it was much more common for people back then to be at least somewhat bilingual or multilingual. At least enough to do to carry out trade. Unless you were a big time trader and then you knew Latin. if you were carrying your goods all around the Mediterranean and then back up to Great Britain, you knew Latin in that case. But if you sold your goods three villages down, you may do that in kind of funky Norman French in one place. When you go into town, but when it comes to when you're at home, you spoke Welsh, mm-hmm. or you spoke English. And that it didn't replace the language as much. And that I don't know if they're right, but that kind of makes sense to me, because when I deal a lot with Hispanics here in California, and English is definitely the dominant language, even among more so than I had originally thought it would be before I started getting involved with Hispanics here in the United States, even among Hispanics themselves. But it hasn't replaced, it's, Americans are really mad about this, it doesn't replace Spanish in that first generation. Like they don't all of a sudden start speaking English at home. You catch my drift? They speak a mix, you know? I wouldn't be surprised if that's what happened to English. I mean, we know that they, because of the English we're speaking right now, you and I, they started adopting a bunch of words. I don't know about it almost dying out. Maybe in the towns. But even so, I wouldn't be surprised if it was, if people would speak Norman French and Latin, depending on who you were, outside the house, especially if you worked with the big dogs. But when you went home, you spoke kind of like people, when they come home here in California, they speak Spanglish at home. Mm-hmm. That's really what, they don't even like speaking flat Spanish. They can't, a lot of them. Proper Spanish. But they speak, and they don't, they're not, many of them are not particularly eloquent in English either. Their language, Spanglish, really. Nah, you know what I'm talking about.
Yeah, oh yeah, I know. I know very well.
I wouldn't be surprised if that's how it was with our ancestors.
Yeah, it wouldn't surprise me either. I kind of do, I've been getting more and more interested in Old English as time has gone by, but I don't have a whole lot of time, unfortunately. But I don't know, I like to research it more. So, and you know I'm interested in dead languages in the future.
Yeah, yes, I am.
When I say dead languages in the future, I mean getting a PhD in a dead language, not interested in languages that shall become dead in the future.
Sorry, Indonesia. Okay, well, this is, it's been a good conversation, but I want to end with another little subject here. Okay, what do you know about the mutual intelligibility of different varieties of Arabic? Since this kind of had a dialectical theme today, kind of a dialectical themed podcast.
I've heard a lot of different things. I've heard some people say, oh, we understand each other just fine. I've had other people say, we don't understand each other at all. But the one that seems to make the most sense, and the one I've gotten from people who have extensive experience in Arabic, is that the farther you get away geographically from your area, from the dialect that you speak of Arabic, the harder it is to understand people. So trying to understand Arabic in Yemen or in certain areas of North Africa, Morocco, Libya, is more difficult to understand than you know, let's say if you live in Syria and you're speaking with a Jordanian. To the point where, in fact, I think I sent you this article. It was all about how the rest of the Arabic-speaking world, would look down upon and make fun of Gaddafi because of his Bedouin dialect and Bedouin accent.
Oh yeah, yeah, he doesn't speak.
So there was a part where they were having a like a pan-Arab convention. He was speaking to, I think it was the president of Egypt. Was it Egypt or Syria? I can't remember. One of them. And the person who was listening to him made some comment about, I can't understand your accent. Everybody kind of giggled about that. But then again, people understand each other by speaking modern standard Arabic, which of course is based off of
classical
Arabic.
Yeah.
But it's not a language anybody really speaks. I think, you know, the Saudis are kind of close, as far as I understand. Mm-hmm. But it's really only a language for the news and for radio and for TV and for politics and business.
So university classes.
Yeah.
What I've heard is you speak MSA in the classroom, but then when you go to your professor for his office hours, the two of you will chat in dialect. Okay, yeah, actually, that's pretty close to what I've heard. I've heard, my experience has been hearing the two opposite views. One, yeah, it's all one language, we understand each other just fine, except for Libya to the west. So we don't understand the Libyans, Tunisians, Algerians, and the Moroccans. But all the rest of us, we understand each other pretty much just fine. And then whenever I come across an article online, they're always saying, no, modern standard Arabic is like Latin, and all of the other, all the dialects, they're like the modern Latin languages, like Spanish and French and Italian and Catalan and Galician and etc., etc. Well, to me, those are all different languages. I mean, some of them are closer than others, but if you know fluent Spanish, you cannot sit down in an Italian movie and really just sit back and enjoy it. Sorry, you can't. You're going to pick up a lot, but you can't just sit back and enjoy it. You got to concentrate the whole time, and even then, you're not going to get it all. So to me, that's okay. You know, the Arabs are kind of like the Chinese. You know, they just need to bust down and realize that they're different languages. But then I had this experience, and I've had I was sitting in the hospital waiting room. Nobody get too excited out there. I was sitting in the waiting room, and I noticed that there were these two guys talking. And I recognized they're speaking Arabic, but one dude I'm sorry, guys, I'm from the States. I'm struggling for the correct PC word. Black, Negro, you know, you could tell. The other guy was not. He wasn't black. But I could tell they were speaking Arabic. Well, you got to have a few countries in sub-Saharan Africa that are Arabic speaking. You got Chad, you've got the Sudan, right? And now you have South Sudan. So I got up the gumption to go talk to a couple of strangers. I'm like, hey, I study languages, and I just want to know, you guys speak in Arabic, right? Yeah. And lucky for me, you know, in this post 9/11 world, these guys were really cool. These guys, they didn't get all jumpy or anything. We had a nice little chat, but I was kind of wondering, okay, you know, your dialects are probably really different, right? They're like, yeah. What do you guys do when you don't understand? Throw in, like, standard Fusha MSA Arabic? They're like, yeah, sometimes we'll throw in some English words, but generally we can understand each other okay, just with our dialects. And the other man, okay, so I found that one man was Sudanese and the other was Iraqi. You know, geographically, you've got a body of water separating them and hundreds of miles. So that's, I imagine that the two don't mix too much. You know, you don't have too many Iraqis going on vacation to Sudan and vice versa. So, anyway, I thought, son of a gun. The only people I can find that can really do that are the Portuguese speakers and the Spanish speakers. If they're really patient with each other and they both are educated, they can have a basic conversation. It's going to be kind of slow, especially for the Spanish speaker, but they can get by. They can. I've been in the airport in São Paulo, Guarulhos Airport, and I've seen Spanish speakers go up, and the Brazilians kind of roll their eyes, and it's tough, but they get by. But yeah, I got a buddy who went to Italy, tried using Spanish, and they responded in English. They're just like, no. We don't understand you. You're obviously an American. And so I thought, well, son of a gun, if you've got two dialects that are pretty darn different, gotta be, and they can understand each other pretty well, that would mean that, you know, the people in Kuwait and the people even in Saudi Arabia should probably be okay. So I had another discussion on Shared Talk, with this lady from Bahrain, and I could tell that she's pretty aware, you know, and her English is pretty good. So I said, hey, could you explain to me some of the differences between the way you speak and the way Saudi Arabians speak? Because, you know, that's pretty close. And the difference, and she like would give me example with words. And the examples she was giving me were like the differences between, seriously, maybe English spoken in London and then English spoken in Manchester. Mm-hmm. You know? Yeah. The sounds change just a little and you have some words here and there. But other than that, you're fine. So now I've kind of swung and I'm like, you know, it's all one language. I guess they are. And MSA, Modern Standard Arabic, that's more akin to maybe Shakespearean English, or for Spanish, what do you call it? Man, I'm blanking. Cervantes, you know, Cervantes era Spanish. That's tough. But, you know, if you're patient, you can get by. And no one actually speaks that way. It sounds very stilted.
Yeah.
It sounds weird. But you understand it. And it doesn't sound, you know, it doesn't sound like Old English, or it doesn't sound like Latin to an Italian or a French person. So anyway, folks, Arabic speakers, want your 2 cents. Want your 2 cents about this subject. Arabs, I want you guys to weigh in. But also, if you learned Arabic to at least an intermediate level, put your 2 cents down. What do you think? Should they be labeled different languages? Oh, the caveat is, yeah, the guys off in the West. In the Western Maghreb, after you get out of Egypt, yeah, that should be denominated a different language. Nobody understands what the heck those guys are saying. But really, Egypt, Egypt to Iraq, Egypt to Oman, those guys, and then what? Lebanon to Yemen. Those guys all understand each other pretty darn well. And that's the majority of the Arab-speaking world, isn't it?
Yep. And of course, everybody understands the Egyptians because of their soap operas.
Mm-hmm. And music videos.
Mm-hmm.
So, yeah. Guys, weigh in on this. I'd love to get some more feedback from people who are actually either native speakers or people who have got a really decent level of in the language. Anyway, that's all we've got for today. So, Cameron, thanks.
Thank you.
Yeah, guys, thank you for listening. Till next time, this is Ryan, the Linguist Blogger.